So every instrument vibrates. There's some physical motion that causes the sound to happen. In an acoustic guitar, there's a sound hole and a resonating body. And when you strum the string, it shakes. And then that sound, that vibration gets amplified into a sound that you end up hearing. So consider an electric guitar. Same thing, but no sound hole amplifier this time. Instead, we have a pickup, which turns some motion into a voltage. But what if I told you there is no guitar? In fact, you can just create sound from nothing. You could just make a voltage. So whatever circuit you can build, you can have it make some voltage and turn that voltage into sound. Same way the electric guitar works, just without the guitar part. So welcome to Sonus Ex Nihilo, sound from nothing. So how do we make sound from nothing? So it starts with a sine wave. So sine wave is one of the simplest types of sounds. There are two ways to look at this. You'll see in the video. So we'll have on the top, we'll have a time domain view, they call it, and on the bottom, a frequency domain. So a sine is at a pure tone at a single frequency, so you'll see a single spike on the bottom. And then on the top, you'll see a familiar wavy shape. All right, so who here has heard of Fourier analysis? Pretty much everybody. Wow, awesome, excellent, EMF, yeah, way to go. All right. So in case you don't know, basics, very hand-wavy explanation, any complex waveform can be turned into a sum of sine waves. So for example, we can make a chord playing just sine. So that's as if sine were your instrument. But you can make any complicated waveform you like. So we'll try to make a sawtooth wave. We don't have an infinite number of sines, so we'll be limited in how well we can reproduce the actual sawtooth. But we'll give it a try. So we'll have 32. So we'll need a few more sines to make a sawtooth exactly. So it's not practical to have an infinite number of oscillators in your synthesizer if you're trying to build one. So there are two shortcuts we can take, two ways to design a synthesizer, and that's subtractive and FM. So subtractive synthesis. There are three steps, basically. You start with a really rich, complicated waveform, and then you filter out the parts that you don't want, just as if you're carving or sculpting. And then after that, you shape that sound over time, and you can play something that sounds more musical. So one of the first synthesizers very popular to follow this technique is called the Minimoog. So Minimoog was a commercialization of a previous synthesizer that explored how to do subtractive synthesis. It's one of the first modular synthesizers. And it's quite expensive in today's money, but still cheaper than an infinite number of sine wave oscillators. So here's the architecture, how it works. You have basically three oscillators that can play different waveforms. You run those into a mixer to mix them all together, and then you have the Moog ladder filter. This filter is a low-pass filter, so it cuts out things above the cutoff, but it also has a feature called resonance where you can emphasize frequencies near that cutoff point. You take the output of the filter, run it through an amplifier. The amplifier can also change the volume of a note over time, and then that is the sound you hear at the end. So the raw material we have to work with, what the Minimoog oscillators can do, we'll explore each of those sounds here. So we'll have a saw, triangle, square, and then some noise. if that's not complex enough, you can do a few different tricks on this synthesizer to make it even more thick and rich. So we'll start with a sawtooth, then we will add another one, an octave up. You'll see what that sounds like. And then we'll add a third, a little bit detuned. Now for the filter. So I've explained the resonance feature already and that it's a cutoff. The cutoff is adjustable and you can tweak a knob on the front panel to control where that's at. So to show you what resonance sounds like, we'll crank up that resonance dial all the way to almost the top. So that'll turn the sine wave, or sorry, the sawtooth that we're outputting into basically a sine wave. So the amplifier can also be controlled with an envelope. So every time you hit a key on the keyboard, you can have it play over time different levels of loudness. Same thing you can do with the filter, which we'll get to next. But I'll show you what the amplitude envelope sounds like by trying to make a plucked, kind of a plucked bass sound. This is no envelope. With the envelope, it's plucked. And with the filter, you can simulate brassy type sounds. So if you start with a little bit slower attack, so a little bit slower, let's say opening up the filter over time, and then setting the cutoff frequency back down as the notes played over time. So this is not loudness. The loudness is the same level. This is just opening and closing the filter. Hiya. Another thing you can do with the oscillator 3 is set it into what's called a low frequency oscillator mode. So this is low enough that we can't hear it as humans. It's around like 10 hertz, 8 hertz, something like this. And you can use that oscillator's output to control other things in the synthesizer. So for example, you control the pitch of another oscillator, or you can control the filter itself. And if you put the filter into almost resonance and have noise go into it, you can make some nice wind sounds. You can see the filter open and close on the bottom there. Right, so putting all that together, this is March 1983. You can, Blue Monday released this, New Order released Blue Monday, and this is the bass riff from that on a Mini Moog. All right, so that's subtractive synthesis. Now enter the Yamaha DX7. So converted to today's money, this is less than a third the cost of the Mini Moog. And this was only a few months after New Order's Blue Monday came out. Completely different sound. Not many knobs or controls on this synthesizer. Quite hard to program, but very expressive. So where did FM come from? So we'll have to go back in time to 1967. Consider John Chowney. He was a composer, researcher working at SAIL at Stanford, their AI lab. He was playing around on one of their old, not at the time old, but PDP-6, Music 5 program. So he would program the computer, hey, make me a sound. I want two signs. I want you to control one of the signs with the other. He'd submit the job and wait many, many minutes to see what it came back as. So we're going to do the same exact thing. So we have two signs. One is doing modulation of a carrier. The carrier is the note you'll hear. The modulator adds the vibrato to it. This was the same 200 hertz carrier the whole time, so the same note. All we were doing was changing how fast vibrato goes. Once vibrato got fast enough, like up into audio range, we hear it differently. We hear it as timbre instead of a wavy vibrato. This is the math, if you're interested. If you're not, plug your ears. All right. So. We have a sign, inside of that another sign. That's how the modulation is working. So the second sign on the inside, you have a frequency in there. That's the vibrato rate, the purple number. And then you have this plugged into the other sign, causing it to move the wave back and forth, which would be the vibrato. The carrier I talked about, the 200 hertz from before, is the green. And index is how far you're allowed to move the FM bands away, like how far the sign will affect the other one. And a nice way to measure that is as a portion of the modulation frequency. Okay, so John Chowning discovered a completely new soundscape, all kinds of sounds you can make with FM. Let's take a tour. So first we'll do his experiment again, but instead of steps where we had to wait minutes between each step, we'll do it smooth, and then we'll go in the other dimension. So instead of moving frequency, we'll move the modulation depth. And then we'll do both at once. Crazy. Most of that sounds bad, but there's a few nice points in there. You might have heard them if you're listening carefully. All right, so the basic building block of FM synthesis is called the operator. This is a combination of the oscillator and envelope. So you can change the modulation over time as you play a note. You can wire them up in what's called an algorithm. The algorithm is the mapping of how operators are connected together. And when you add algorithms into the mix here, you have crazy dimensional space of all kinds of sounds. So let's pick a few points that sound nice and hear what those are like. So those were in what we heard before, almost. You might have missed them, but those are quite nice sounds. Those were some of the presets that are shipped on the Yamaha DX7. So the Yamaha engineers discovered these points in that hyperspace somehow, and after they discover them, program them in, so everyone uses these presets. As I mentioned, it's quite hard to program this thing. Finding a good sound in that huge space is difficult. As well. So most people just use these presets. All right, so what's it take to build a DX7? We will need, let's say we want to play more than one note at a time. So the mini Moog was monophonic, meaning one note at a time. We want to do multiple, so we'll do 16, because we have lots of fingers. Okay, so if we have 16, and each one of those we want to make up of six different FM operators, we'll need 96 operators total. And to run those operators, what they do is they do a sign calculation, and they do an envelope calculation inside each one. So that's a lot of multiplications per second to apply all of these operations. Just for comparison, we have Commodore 64 do about 5,000 per second, IBM 35,000, the Intel PC like 10 years into the future, still only 4 million. The DX7 has to do 19 million of these. So the tricks to build this, to make it happen, is instead of computing sign, you use a lookup table, for one. So this first trick. So one lookup table can make any frequency of sign. How you make different frequencies is by jumping around in different step widths. You can also take advantage of the quarter wave symmetry of the sine wave. So you don't have to store one full period of sine. You could just have to store a quarter of that and flip it around and mirror it. And then you can have one quarter reduction of the space. Another trick, you don't have to multiply if you can add. If we use a trick from slide rules, where you take the work in log space, so you can multiply numbers together just by adding. So if you have log of 2, log of 3, you can make log of 6. Now if you want to get the 6 back out, you'll have to do exp, which is fine. There's another table, right? Or you don't have to have it another table. You could bake it in. So it could be, exp is still a separate table. But to go to log space, you don't have to do another table lookup. You can put that inside, pre-baked into your table. So you don't have a sine lookup table anymore. You have a log of sine of x table. So all of that so far was either like obvious, other people knew about it, or was disclosed in Yamaha's patents for a DX7. But Ken Shirriff decapped the chip that's at the heart of the DX7 and did some very good reverse engineering work. And I'll share with you what I thought was interesting from his work. So this is the chip opened up, put under the microscope. Metal layer stripped off, and zoomed in on this log sine ROM. Some interesting patterns here, which I can't read, but Ken Shirriff did and explained it very well. So top recommend his blog post on the topic. All right, so first thing, they use a trick called delta encoding. So this is the log sine table on the right there. Even at the steepest portion, if you put the numbers out, each entry in that table, they're close together. So you say we have spatial locality here. Whenever you have spatial locality in your function you're trying to build a lookup table for, you can benefit from delta encoding. So how this works is you store every fourth value as an absolute reference point. So this is the full value. But then you only have to store tiny deltas, which you add back on as needed later. And storing those deltas, because you are leveraging spatial locality, because they're close by, don't need as many bits as storing the full value every time. So for example, you have the value 7722 at the fourth entry. You can store the entries before it, 0, 1, 2, with a little delta. So each one of those has a different value, a different delta. Everything at the multiple of 4 position that starts at n equals 0 will be a delta 0. So if we go to n equals 4, that would be added as a delta 0. So it's like a mod 4 operation to get the which delta family it's belonging to. The next trick is planar organization. So you put everything together into a group. So all of the delta zeros, put them into one big delta zero array, all of the delta ones into one big delta one array, all of the delta twos into one big delta two array, so forth. Once they're together, you can take a stack of 256 of these, lay it out as 8x32, and that looks like this blue square on the right. And then a single line of that, just to show you, you see the ones and zeros, these are actual bits, finally. So the reason you'd organize it this way is you end up with lots of zeros in rows. And when you're building a hardware ASIC device, zeros are free. You can leave them out. You don't need to put a transistor down unless it needs to go somewhere other than default. So you take advantage of patterns of the address lines, how things are, the logic used to access the values from the chip. If it would always return zero for a class of values, you can not put transistors there. You don't need space in the chip. So this gave the biggest savings. So we went from around almost 60,000 bits, just storing a log sign table at full, take a quarter wave, do the delta encoding and zeroing, and you end up around 11 times smaller than what you started. Okay. Do you recognize this song? Sound familiar, anybody? Show of hands. No. Okay, good. I made up the song. But I use the most common preset on the DX7, which is Electronic Piano Number 1. So if it sounded familiar, it's because of the sound. Anyway, I didn't get any of you. All right, worth a try. All right. So in summary, we've covered three different ways to make sounds out of nothing. The additive synthesis, where we have infinite number of sine waves. We've covered subtractive, where you build a rich sound and then carve out the bits you don't want. And then we've also talked about FM, where things diddle each other and it gets complex. All right, so I will leave you with two best effort pianos. So one on a Juno 60 synthesizer, which is using subtractive, same as a Mini Moog, and then the other DX7 trying to be a grand piano. Grand piano. If you'd like to play around with any of the synthesizer stuff with me, I'll be hanging around Trash Compactor and hope to catch you there and goof around with audio. Thank you.